Number 2.
Among the many types of extinct elephant relatives we find in Florida, the shovel tuskers are perhaps the most bizarre. They have these huge lower tusks that appear to resemble shovels. However, analysis by Florida researchers has determined that they use these lower tusks for many purposes, including digging and scratching bark off of trees. This specimen, along with one other jaw, was found in Marion County during the construction of a racetrack for thoroughbred horses. This particular species, Amebelodon brodii, is the largest known land animal to ever live in Florida. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 22.
Alligators are quite common in the Florida fossil record. At Thomas Farm, we preserve a large sample of 18 million-year-old alligators that belong to the extinct species Alligator olsoni. Researchers have determined that it is an evolutionary intermediate and ancestor to both the modern American and Chinese alligators. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 50.
Megalodon is really interesting because it was definitely a top apex predator in the world's oceans between about 20 and 2 million years ago when it finally became extinct. So for a long time, there's been a controversy among scientists that based on the triangular shape of the tooth of Megalodon, scientists used to believe that it was similar to the triangular shaped tooth of a modern great white, and therefore it was the ancestor of a modern great white, but it was much larger. And now scientists are looking at other characteristics like the development of the serrations on the edge of the tooth and think that Megalodon is a cousin to the great white and not the direct ancestor. The growth rings in the vertebrae of the Megalodon and other sharks as well indicate periodic growth or deposition of the bony material within the vertebrae, and you can see these seasonal bandings, and they're very much like the seasonal bandings in tree rings. So scientists can march from the middle of the backbone, the vertebrae, to the edge and count the number of these segments or these incremental growth rings and have a general estimate for how old the animal was. It doesn't hold true all the time. Sometimes if the animal's stressed, then there isn't a growth ring, but it's a first approximation for understanding how old the animal was, which is really cool that we can age the individual animal that lived millions of years ago. So Megalodon is really interesting to the general public. When I go to school kids in California or Florida and I show them a Megalodon tooth, even if they're in third grade or whatever, they know what it is. So it's sort of like the new dinosaur of the 21st century. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 51.
Fossil horses have been long used to study evolution. In Florida, we are very fortunate to have an 18-million-year-old sample right at the time when horses are transitioning from browsing forest-dwelling animals to open country grazing animals. The Thomas Farm Parahippus has thousands of specimens recording this transition. We're able to study these jaws to determine that the wear on their teeth is about 50% greater than those of browsing horses. That put evolutionary pressure on the species to increase the height of the crown so the animals could live longer and have more progeny. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 58.
Beginning about 10 years ago, a few scientists at the Florida Museum of Natural History and I, along with different Bahamian scientists, got heavily involved in retrieving fossils from blue holes in the Bahamas, especially on the island of Abaco. The initial discovery of these fossils was made by scuba diver Brian K. Cook, who noticed when he dove down, got about 60, 70 feet deep in this blue hole that was completely dark, there was no light. Just lying on the surface were entire skeletons of extinct species of tortoises and crocodiles. This was a fossil discovery second to none in the West Indies as far as how well preserved these entire skeletons were. So working with Brian and other scuba divers, we've retrieved a selected sample of these large fossils And the beauty of the fossils is that we can do all sorts of research on them that normally can't be done with fossils. In other words, they still have their organics left in the bone, so we can radiocarbon date them very accurately. We can look at the stable isotope signatures of this extinct tortoise and crocodile in order to reconstruct their diet. And these sorts of finds have really revolutionized what we know about evolution of large animals in the Bahamas and, by default, throughout the West Indies. We've learned that this crocodile was, in fact, a terrestrial, not an aquatic predator, so that's pretty different than crocodiles in continental situations. We learned that both the crocodile and the tortoise became extinct about 1,000 years ago, which is roughly when the first people arrived in the Bahamas. I'm David Stedman. I'm the curator of ornithology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 59.
Mammoths first appeared in Florida about 1.5 million years ago. Late in their chronologic range, a new predator appeared on their scene, humans. We know humans hunted mammoths, mastodons, and other large prey in Florida because of marks and butchering marks on their bones, and they used parts of them for tools. How much human interaction and hunting pressure is related to the extinction of these large animals is still a great question and debate among scientists. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 66.
So horses are generally thought by the public to have been introduced to North America about 500 years ago by the Spaniards. But as paleontologists, we know that horses actually evolved in North America over the past 50 million years. And they migrated outside of North America into the Old World. They also migrated into South America after the formation of the Isthmus of Panama a couple of million years ago. And in addition, the saber-toothed cat skull that you see here represents an animal that, along with horses, also migrated into South America across the Isthmus of Panama during what's called the Great American Biotic Interchange. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 67.
So paleontologists know that certain animals evolved in South America millions of years ago, and after the formation of the Isthmus of Panama, certain groups of those animals migrated northward. So the cool thing about Florida is that we have lots of fossils from the animals that came from South America into North America, and these are found at literally hundreds of localities throughout our state and are represented by animals like the giant armadillo and ground sloths. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 68.
About 100 years ago, paleontologists discovered this spectacular bone bed of fossil rhinoceros bones and skulls in western Nebraska. And these represent rhinoceroses that lived in North America about 20 million years ago, and these bone beds were excavated in large chunks and they were sent to different museums all around the country. And the one that you see on display here is one that was given to us early on when we developed our collections of fossil vertebrates. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 69.
Although we think of rhinos today as living in Africa and Asia, they once had a much wider distribution. In North America, rhinos were common, particularly in the Miocene epoch, between about 25 to 7 million years ago. Rhinos got as far south in North America as Panama, as shown by this lower jaw. They were particularly common in Florida, including the mounted skeleton in the fossil hall, as well as this lower jaw. The lower jaw from Florida is from an 8-million-year-old fossil site from near the town of Newberry, just west of Gainesville. The large tusk-like tooth in the front of the lower jaw tells us this was a male individual. This particular kind of rhinoceros did not have a horn to protect itself. They had large tusks formed by their incisor teeth. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 102.
So fossil sharks don't usually preserve except for their teeth, and usually the teeth are found isolated. And in this particular specimen found by Dr. Hubble in the Peruvian desert, the entire skull and jaws and the cartilage were preserved somehow. We're not quite exactly sure. And it preserves the entire tooth row of this ancestral great white shark. And it's like the best specimen of its kind in the entire world. So Dr. Hubble found this particular specimen in the 1980s. And about 10 years ago, we decided to go back to try to relocate the locality in the middle of nowhere in the desert of southern Peru. And we had X marked the spot on a topographic map. We spent a couple of days and finally we actually found the place. We found the hole in the ground from 30 years before and it still had plaster and a few more teeth. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 107.
For many years, fossil collecting at the Florida Museum of Natural History and most museums was limited to museum staff and graduate students. In 1984, a huge fossil discovery south of Tampa called the Licey Shell Pit changed the way we work at fossil sites. At that site, we had such a large accumulation of fossils, we required extra persons to excavate the site in a timely manner. We were able to use media, television, newspaper accounts, to attract hundreds of volunteers. From this, we learned that the public's fascination with fossils could be used to help us collect fossils at many future fossil sites. You are always welcome to check our volunteer website to determine when the next volunteer fossil dig is occurring. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 111.
When we're out at a fossil site and we find a fragile or rare fossil, we want to make a plaster jacket around the fossil to bring it back to the museum where we can prep it in a slow and methodical way instead of out in the field where it would be exposed to the elements and potentially fall apart. So what we do is we dig a trench around the specimen when we find it and we try to figure out exactly what the limits of that specimen are. And then once we've dug the trench around the specimen, we take plaster bandages and wrap the whole pedestaled specimen that's still in the dirt underneath, and then we undercut the specimen, flip it over, and bring him back to the museum. Once it's at the museum, we can then methodically and slowly, under microscopes and with dental picks and brushes, prep the specimen and glue it so that it can stay intact and doesn't fall apart. And if we were to try to lift it out of the ground, you know, when we first find it, it would just explode into a million pieces. So we want to do it the most careful way we can. My name is Jason Bork. I'm the fossil preparator at the Florida Museum of Natural History in the Division of Vertebrate Paleontology.
Number 137.
Carbonomes is a very large freshwater turtle that we found in the same rocks as Titanoboa at the Cerrejón coal mine in northern Colombia. And the first thing that it struck us when we discovered this animal was that it, like Titanoboa, was so incredibly large. And in fact, it is the largest freshwater turtle known on the planet for this time at 58 million years ago. And also what's very interesting about Carbonomes is that, like Titanoboa, it's related to animals that are living in the Amazon today. So Carbonomes is a Pleurodira turtle. That means it's a side-neck turtle. And these are the kinds of turtles that you see in the Amazon today. However, they are much smaller. We estimate that Carbonomes would have been around 5.5 feet long, which is smaller than some sea turtles that you find today. But for freshwater turtles, that's a very large freshwater turtle. And you don't see turtles becoming larger than that, even in the fossil record, till some tens of millions of years later. So it's the undisputed largest turtle during that 10 million year interval of time after the extinction of the dinosaurs. Another interesting thing about Carbonomes are the puncture marks that we see on its shell. We can see these depressions pushed in the shell that look very much like the types of puncture marks that you see on the shells of side-neck turtles that have been bitten by crocodiles in ecosystems today. While we can't take a time machine and go back and actually see this happening, it's not so far-fetched to say that the crocodiles during this time were trying to eat these turtles. Another interesting thing about the shells of these side-neck turtles from Cerrejón is that they are very thick, and this may have been in part an adaptation to avoid predation by these giant crocodilians in their ecosystem. The turtles, like Carbonomys here, when they were younger, probably formed part of the diet of the largest predators in this ecosystem. If you go to the Amazon today, for example, the side-necked turtles are often preyed upon by the anacondas. So it wouldn't be completely out of the question that Titanoboa might have eaten some of these side-necked turtles, although probably not a Carbonomys of this size. I'm Jonathan Block, and I'm curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History on the University of Florida campus.
Number 138.
Titanoboa saronensis is the world's largest snake, as far as we know. We estimate that it could have been between 45 and 50 feet long, that it could have been maybe 3 feet wide, and would have weighed over a ton. And, you know, with all of these dimensions, it can be difficult to try to imagine, you know, what that means in terms of the size of a snake. So one of the ways that I try to imagine it is that if it were to try to come in, say, through your office door, it would have to squeeze through to get at you. So that provides a better image, I think. This was a truly gigantic animal. And in fact, it was the largest predator that we know of on the face of the planet following the extinction of the dinosaurs. Fossils of Titanoboa saronensis were found in a coal mine in northern Colombia in tropical South America. The age of the rocks that they were found in is about 58 million years old. And what was really exciting about the coal mine initially was that it preserved the ancient remnants of a rainforest. So this was the oldest evidence for a rainforest that we'd had from South America. So when we started to find bones of the animals that lived in that rainforest, this was very exciting to us because literally it was like opening a window into the past for the first time, opening that window into tropical South America a few million years after the extinction of the dinosaurs, and looking to see what these animals, you know, look like. When we opened that window, one of the things we found was this absolutely gigantic snake. And the first question that we had was, you know, why do we not have snakes this large today in the rainforests of South America? This snake, which seems to have been related to anacondas and boas, so why didn't that get larger? And the answer to that question, we think, is that in the past, 58 million years ago in South America, it was also much hotter. And this is important for cold-blooded vertebrates like Titanoboa because they derive their body temperature from the ambient temperature, the temperature in their environment, as opposed to deriving the temperature from the food that they eat, like a warm-blooded animal does. And because of that, cold-blooded reptiles cannot get beyond a certain body mass without their metabolism slowing so far down that they wouldn't, say, be able to eat at a certain temperature. So on the equator, we have the largest snakes today, and they get as large as they possibly can given the temperatures that they're living in. The only thing that would allow us to build a larger snake would be to relax those temperatures, and those temperatures would become warmer. So we think that Titanoboa became as large as it did because temperatures were maybe even as much as 10 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than they are today. People always ask me, does that mean that with future global warming, we'll have larger snakes appearing on the planet? And the answer to that is theoretically, yes, we could get larger snakes with global warming. But I also would add that while that's true in theory, in fact, probably we won't, because one of the things that would be required to build such a large snake, even from something like an anaconda, would be the appropriate habitat. And that's one thing that is rapidly disappearing in various parts of the planet, especially some of the more biodiverse places in the tropics. So the habitat might not be there. Also, the interaction with humans could certainly keep these very large snakes from reappearing. And the other thing is that the global warming that we think we will experience within the next, say, 200 years is happening so much more rapidly than the very long ramp up towards warmer climate that was happening that probably resulted in the large body sizes that we see in Titanoboa 58 million years ago. I'm Jonathan Block, and I'm curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History on the University of Florida campus.
Number 139.
Anthracosuchus balragus was unearthed from the same layer of rock as Titanoboa in the Cerrejón coal mine of northern Colombia. The species is named for a ferocious fictional creature, the balrog, that appeared in Tolkien's novel the Lord of the Rings. And that creature lived deep in the mines of Moria in Middle-earth. So the allusion is to the fact that we dug up the fossils of Anthracoceuchus balragus from down in the very depths of a very deep coal mine. That coal mine actually is a very interesting place to work because not only do we find these incredible fossils, but the conditions are a little bit surreal in the sense that because it's so hot in the tropics and because the coal seams themselves are so thick that they are every once in a while spontaneously combusting. So the coals are burning and there's quite a bit of sulfur in the coals, so they have a very sulfuric smell. And so you'll see flames and smoke and smell sulfur sort of belching out of these pits as you're crawling around looking for fossils. So it's not hard to imagine sort of a Middle Earth kind of scenario while you're collecting those fossils. Anthracoceuchus shows us all kinds of things with regards to what was alive during the time of Titanoboa. Anthracoceuchus is also a large predator like Titanoboa, certainly not the apex predator of that ecosystem. Only that large snake occupies that title, I think. But it was nevertheless a large predator, around 16 feet, and would have weighed maybe around 900 pounds. It has a very boxy skull, which shows us that it was probably eating hard objects, probably not as focused on fish as we see with the other crocodiles at Cerrejón. And based on the bite marks that we see on the large side neck turtles from the Cerrejón coal mine, we think that this animal in part would have preyed on the turtles that we find in the coal mine. Dinosaur crocodiles, which Anthracoceuchus balragus is one, are really interesting because these are animals that survived the KP boundary, which marks the extinction of the dinosaurs, as well as the extinction of marine reptiles on the planet. And most of the diversity of dinosaur crocodiles is in the ocean. So at the time of the extinction of the dinosaurs, they were, you know, for the most part, marine reptiles. We think that one of the ways they might have been able to survive that extinction event is by moving up into these river systems in South America and then diversifying into things like Anthracoceuchus. I'm Jonathan Block, and I'm curator of vertebrate paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History on the University of Florida campus.
Number 145.
The largest fossil animal on display in the museum is the mammoth skeleton, technically Mammuthus columbi. It was found submerged on the bottom of the Ocilla River in north central Florida. In the same deposit, the mastodon skeleton was also found, so they were contemporaneous. Mammoths primarily eat grass, where mastodons are primarily eating leaves and other browse. Both of them were facing a new predator, the humans that had just invaded the North American continent, and liked to use their bones and tusks for tools. There are only two known mounted skeletons on public display of mammoths from Florida. The one you see here, and the other one is far north of here at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 147.
Those jaws were put back together by a retired physician in Jacksonville named Dr. Jeremiah, and his passion was, on the weekends, reconstructing fossil shark jaws, and he donated all of those jaws that are in the front of the fossil hall to the museum, and if we had tried to go out and purchase those or acquire them, they basically are priceless. And they're unique. Really, really cool. Well, what was interesting is that when we first put this jaw on display, there were some concerns because it says it's from the St. John's River. These are teeth from the St. John's River of an animal that used to live there millions of years ago. But some of the public were concerned that maybe these megalodons still lived in the St. John's River. So we had to retrofit a label that said this animal's now extinct. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 148.
So Parahippus is a horse that evolved in North America about 18 million years ago. And one of the best examples of Parahippus in all the United States comes from Thomas Farm, a fossil site that's about an hour northwest of Gainesville. Parahippus is interesting because, based on the shape of its teeth, scientists know that it was what we might call a transitional feeder, where it was going from feeding on leaves of trees to horses that initially were feeding on grasses like they do today. That skull was put back together back about 30 or 35 years ago when I first got here. And we had somebody working in he was the exhibit, and he was putting the specimen back together. Bob Allen was his name. I'm Bruce McFadden. I'm a curator of vertebrate paleontology and also a distinguished professor. And I work at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 149.
The Florida terror bird, scientifically Titanus walleri, was first discovered in the Santa Fe River in the early 1960s. Since then, we have accumulated several dozen bones of the animal, but we're not able to fully reconstruct its skeleton. Therefore, a sculptor was hired to produce this artistic endeavor, trying to use as much of the real bones as he could to create a lifelike, life-size reconstruction of Titanus walleri. Terror birds evolved in South America and crossed into North America via the Panamanian land bridge about 5 million years ago. This species is only known from fossils from Texas and Florida. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 150.
Most people don't realize that there was more than one type of saber-toothed cat. In fact, in Florida, we have about a half a dozen different species. In the Pleistocene, the genus Smilodon includes two species, the large tiger-sized Smilodon fatalis, and the skull in the case, the leopard or jaguar-sized Smilodon gracilis. The world's largest sample of Smilodon gracilis comes from near Tampa at the famous Licey Shell Pit. Richard Holbert, Collection Manager of Vertebrate Paleontology at the Florida Museum of Natural History.
Number 151.
This specimen of Hespero testuda incisa is incredibly rare, and it was found in the Hale Quarry, which is about a half hour from here in Gainesville. It's incredibly rare in that it's a complete skeleton of this animal, which has never been seen before. And it's about the size of the modern gopher tortoise. We don't know if they dug burrows or not, like gopher tortoises, but they did have an armored pad on their tail. So they either dug burrows and had this armored pad exposed at the end of the burrow, or they dug themselves under bushes and things and had this protective shield on their back end. My name is Jason Bork. I'm the fossil preparator at the Florida Museum of Natural History in the Division of Vertebrate Paleontology.